Good morning. Good morning, meeting of the Watershed, Wetlands, and Buffers Subcommittee. The Environmental Finance Committee will be called to order. We do have a quorum. How do we call the roll?
Okay. Hanson?
Yes.
Ansel?
Yes.
Doty?
Here.
Gunther?
Here.
Hoppy? Peterson? Engelstad? Looking at the next issue.
Yes, here.
Great. And we need to approve the minutes from March 21st, November 6th, and December 19th.
Mr. Chair, I move approval of those minutes.
Doty moves approval of the minutes. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
We have four witnesses.
Four minutes approved. We have a long agenda today, and I know that there are other committees meeting and members may come and go. You have the agenda in front of you. There are a couple bills that have not been introduced yet, so we will go through those. This is the first finance meeting, just a little bit on process. The capital investment bills are assigned to the divisions, so Representative Wagenius's committee receives those requests that relate to the Department of Natural Resources, Pollution Control Agency, and the Board of Water and Soil Resources. She has referred by letter to the Board of Water and Soil Resources projects, or that relate to Bowser, to this subcommittee. We will consider those bills, or portions of bills that relate to Bowser, and then we will move those back to Representative Wagenius's committee. And then Representative Wagenius is going to be holding a multitude of hearings on Department of Natural Resources and Pollution Control Agency proposals, and then those will go to the Capital Investment Committee. So that's kind of the step process. And so we're the first in line, and we hope to get through this today. We have scheduled a meeting for Monday where we'll probably move the bill. And part of the issue here is that we may need to, we don't have any targets, but there's only a certain amount of money that's available. So we have to look at what money we do have and how we can apply that appropriately. So first we'll have an overview on the governor's budget request, and Mr. Jaski, if you want to come forward, and anyone else.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Members, I'm John Jaski, Executive Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources. With me is Kevin Lyons, Business Section Manager. Also in the audience today is Tim Holder from Natural Resources Conservation Service, because we do a great deal of our program work with their organization. He's better prepared to answer than we are. I'll just walk right through the presentation. You need to pass it. There are three items that the agency has included in the governor's recommendation. The first is the reinvest in Minnesota reserve program. This is a long-standing program that's been in existence for 20 years, and it basically is set up to do two things, two very important things, to restore wetlands and to restore riparian buffer areas. And to do that by acquiring conservation easements, long-term conservation easements on these lands from willing landowners, and then we install the practices to accomplish the wetland restoration. Sometimes it's structural undertaking, sometimes it's breaking tile, various kinds of activities, so we put the water back where it was. And then we also use a number of practices to establish native seeds, either in wet areas or the buffer areas along those wetlands. The purpose of the program, the benefits include certainly water quality, and while the habitat are the two principal benefits that we've identified over the years, and we've also acknowledged more recently the present sequestration value of those projects, and it's important to note too that the job development of these projects, we end up hiring contractors to do the earthwork and seed vendors to provide the native grass and other plant nurseries. We have realty people working on the appraisals if they're necessary and title work. So there's a lot of people involved in putting these landscapes back to the way they were and into long-term conservation. You can see in the photographs there some of the pictures of projects that have been done in the past. We work very, very closely with our stormwater conservation district to make this successful. And of course, it is successful because it works for landowners, number one. They've got to have an interest in doing these projects and be willing to work with a local organization that can be there when they have questions and want to understand their options. Secondly, those stormwater districts have both the role of working with landowners, but also they spend a good bit of their effort on looking at designs and working with the landowner and the contractors to get the project accomplished. And certainly, Bowser provides the oversight, the engineering, and a lot of the vehicle work to get these lands enrolled. We also have a long-term obligation to do the monitoring and maintenance of these sites in conjunction with our stormwater conservation district. I'll turn to page four and get right to the part about the money. As I mentioned before, I'm a co-worker here from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and Natural Resource Conservation Service, and one of the really important parts of our program is that we're able to dovetail it with their Wetland Reserve Program, WRP. And in doing so, we generally estimate that there's a 1.4-to-1 ratio in that if the state provides a dollar, the federal program provides about a dollar for every expenditure that we come up with. And not only programs linked, but it's almost necessary to have them linked in today's environment because of the rising land values. We alone would have very much difficulty making these projects happen to be able to provide landowners enough funding with our current program structure to get the job done, but we've been very successful when we link up with their program, and I think they would get a ton of ours. And so, as you know, you can see there, the governor's recommendation was $20 million over the biennium. There are several federal fiscal years, you can see there in the green, that we estimate would have funding available for the WRP program that we could leverage. You know, $15 in each of those, $50 million in each of those federal fiscal years is our best estimate. There are some dollars right now in Washington that are available for this program, but they're only available to the middle of March because of the federal farm bill only at this point being funded or extended through that date. We're not quite sure what's going to happen, but we know there'll be a new farm bill, and we're 99.9% sure that WRP is going to be in that bill. So we're looking ahead to the future federal fiscal years as well. Last year we had, in the bonding bill, we had an opportunity to do the same thing. Of course, the state bonding bill did not get passed, and so the money we had in Minnesota, which was, I think, $13 million, ended up having to go back to Washington. So we'd like to be able to keep that federal dollar here in Minnesota and accomplish more than double what we would do with only state money. So I think that's a very important part of our program and our working with NRCS.
Mr. Daske, Representative Gunther and I were talking there, and I wasn't quite sure if I heard we turned $13 million back last year. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct, Mr. Chairman. I'll assume if you give me the number, that is the number, according to the report. So that's the summary of the RIM program, and you can see on page 5 the details of how we get those projects accomplished. We do it in partnership, again, as I mentioned, with our local governments and with those landowners. And the workers that get the job done include the local governments, but also these private sector business enterprises, as I mentioned earlier, contractors, seed vendors, and realty specialists.
Mr. Jaschke, yeah. Could you talk a little bit about technical assistance? And I think in the governor's recommendation, he has the technical assistance being general fund versus general obligation. Can you highlight that a little bit or explain that?
Chairman, the governor's recommendation had $1.8 million as the general fund for implementation. Two comments about that. One, in the past, we have been able to use bonding funds that have been designated for implementation, so general fund has a little bit more flexibility, but we've never had that kind of funding. We've always used the bonding funds as implementation. and we've had between 15 and 20% allocated for that purpose in several binding, well, forever basically, as far back as we can see, there's been a 15 to 20% cost implementation for the state and the local governments and some of the contracts that we left for those projects. Any other questions on the reinvestment of the program?
Representative Lenius has a question.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Hi. One of it is you're contracting for services in here, we have the Minnesota Conservation Corps. Would they be one of the groups that would be working on these projects?
Chairman, the answer is yes. It's not every project, certainly, but some. We've got an agreement that we signed with the Minnesota Conservation Corps last early summer. And the first place we use their expertise and their services down in the southeast to do some of the same kind of projects down there with the flood damage that occurred. And we expect to expand that to different parts of the state as their availability and expertise becomes available. We have an agreement with them that allows us to move them where they're able to go and where we need them.
Representative Doty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jassy, would you comment briefly on how's it going with lifetime easements compared to the 20 years from that?
The statute requires that wetland restorations in Minnesota be permanent easements, perpetual easements. And that makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of investment up front, and once you do that, you want to keep that wetland there. I'll talk a little bit later about another program essentially that has more of a temporary nature to it with the conservation project. The federal government has sort of two approaches to it, and we have the thing in Minnesota, we've much more emphasized the permanent side of it with our dollars. They have the CRP program, which is a contract for temporary or short-term conservation. And one of the things that you'll notice in your packet, the last page, I believe it is, there's a map that looks with a bunch of dots on it. These are the current short-term conservation contracts that the federal government, U.S. Department of Agriculture, or Farm Service Agency has enrolled. Then these are the ones that are going to be expiring in the next few years. The dots represent about 250,000 acres of both conservation practices that will go away. And already 80,000 acres have expired as of September 30th. And so the two things we want to do with that reinvestment of water program is, one, we want to go out and find wetland restorations that are in, high priority areas that need to be accomplished. But secondly, where the opportunity presents itself and where these landowners are interested in preserving what they've already done for conservation and making it long-term, we would use those funds for that as well. So we preserve the investment that's already there and I think get a better bargain for our state funding. So our approach is to try and pursue long-term conservation as a priority.
Representative Doty, do you feel that that will get us enough, or is there are there a lot of people just simply not willing to commit lifetime, or are we doing okay with that?
Again, whatever works for the landowner, but the easements that we've secured thus far, you see there's with about 5,000 easements and 190,000 acres, the vast majority, I can't give a number, but it's over 90% of those are perpetual, 98% of those are perpetual easements, so landowners have bought into that approach.
Okay.
Then I will continue on to the next item, which is...
I did have a follow-up, because you did mention the flood, and could you maybe just send a minute on, we provided $1 million for RIM in the special session, and has that been spent, and is there additional demand?
Chairman, the additional $1 million has been allocated. We had a sign-up period that went through the end of January, and those applications are being prioritized. Our agency also allocated another $1.1 million of existing appropriations to that same area, and that also will be allocated. And there's about another $2.4 million that could be used in that area based on the sign-ups we received during that enrollment period. And we would certainly be able to use some of these funds for that purpose if they were a priority or if they were designated.
Okay.
Next item is our love and replacement is required by state statute. Back in the mid-1990s, the state took on the responsibility of replacing wetlands that were impacted due to local government road authority projects. We had, of course, many, many road authorities building roads and upgrading them, and often they would nick a wetland, and then they would have to accomplish the wetland replacement or mitigation for that under state law, and federal law for that matter. And what this legislature did then was to say, well, we need to replace those wetlands, but let's see if we can do it in a more efficient way, which is to pool all those smaller impacts and then have the state accomplish the restoration of wetlands to offset that. And so the state has then, in every year since then, appropriated money from the bonding source to accomplish this obligation. So again, many of the same kinds of benefits you'll get from the rim reserve type wetland restorations are accomplished under these projects, except that this is done under a regulatory mandate rather than under a net gain of wetlands approach. So I won't go into a lot more details except to say that one of the things that happened was that the bonding bill has a lot more transportation funding in it. And the amount of wetlands that will be affected or impacted by that, of course, is sort of proportional to the amount of money available to build roads. And so the amount that's in the governor's recommendation will get us going, certainly for the first year, but we'll have to see how much transportation funding increases are actually going to happen and then what that might mean for the amount of wetlands we have to replace as a part of that. So a little more analysis may be needed on that one.
Mr. Cash, what's the technical assistance portion there?
Yeah, I believe the number on that one was $720,000, which is about 15%, 14%, something like that. So that one number is certainly where it's been in the past, and we can make that work, I think, pretty well. Same points about your earlier question regarding general fund versus bonding. That has always also been allocated out of the bonding source for getting an implementation accomplished.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jaskie, is there anywhere within your agency or elsewhere the ability to get a handle on total costs of wetland replacements as it relates to public road construction or maintenance or best practices? This seems to me that the trend line is favoring more investment in this area, and that in order to accurately budget and do our work, we need to get a handle on the costs.
It's a good point. You know, the costs are going up, you know, the need is going up, I think, in proportion to the transportation funding available. The more roads that are being built, the more likely they are to hit a wetland. And in your area, it's virtually impossible to build anything without hitting a wetland. The other factor, of course, is land values are going up. It's kind of all over. And so those are the two variables that impact the need for the cost for this program. And you can see in the map on page 8, you know, we've got the state divided into three zones, basically, for regulatory purposes. And we have an obligation to put the wetlands back kind of where they came from as the first priority, although there's some flexibility for the northeastern part of the state to replace wetlands elsewhere. And so you can see the map then on page 9 shows the places where we've, you know, established wetland banking credits. You know, we look for opportunities, you know, all over the state, but, you know, there's more opportunities in some places than others. And one thing that will be helpful to our agency, hopefully, as well as a number of folks in northeastern Minnesota, is that last year the legislature funded a study to look for the best opportunities in northeastern Minnesota to find wetland mitigation. And if it doesn't exist, then we'll have to go somewhere else. And that'll help us as an agency in accomplishing this responsibility, but also help other developers and projects that are going to impact wetlands. So part of that analysis will be to find the most cost-effective way to accomplish that. I will proceed on then to page 10, I guess it is, which is RIM Clean Energy. And in your packet, there's also a report Kevin's got it here. We haven't got the pretty one public yet. We just got this finished a week or two ago. But last legislative session, we were directed to prepare develop a program that would use conservation easements as a mechanism to stimulate the biofuel production from native vegetation. And we were directed to convene a group of stakeholders, and you can see in this report, those folks are listed near the beginning of the report, I think, being on page 2. And quite a few different folks that spent several months beginning in September through January preparing this report. The report required two things. It required the agency to establish a process to pick or select a project area to try it, because again, it's a new endeavor, and we wanted to pilot it over one or more project areas. And those project areas are, of course, centered around a production facility, which is a new twist on the full conservation easement thing. It's meant to be a working lands conservation program, with the idea that generating biofuel is the first priority, and obviously achieving the conservation benefits of having native grasses or other plants as the perennial cover on that landscape will provide habitat, water quality, some of the other things we talked about earlier. But again, central for this is the idea that a plant be interested and available for this biomass. And on page 11, there's a list of facilities that are, based on inventory that was done by the Department of Commerce, that are in existence, and some estimates about where they are and what kind of fuel they're using and how much fuel they might be able to use in a given year. Earlier, folks asked, and maybe we should have put it in this table, but it talks about the tons per year that could be used, and the question was, how many acres does it take to make a ton? Well, the conversion factor that I've been given from the experts is that 1 acre can generate about 4 to 5 tons of biomass per year. So that kind of tells you, how many acres are needed to potentially meet the volume that any one of these plants could utilize. The other thing we were directed to do was develop a tiered payment system, and that's on page 19. And you'll get a nice pretty version of this at some point when it's published in the next couple of weeks, but this lays out a way that we would incent landowners to enroll lands that are, not prime agricultural production lands for commodity crops, but lands that are maybe more on the margin of that, for example, around a wetland restoration or some such thing. We came up with this payment scheme based on input from the University of Minnesota economists. They did the analysis, but they also did another thing. They went out and actually talked to people on the land and asked them, what would it take for you to be interested? Because it's one thing to sit and do the analysis from a bunch of numbers, and we have lots of numbers on land sales. However, they're always lagging. By the time the data actually gets collected and recorded, we know that land prices are going up, and university and Bowser have developed a website where university updates the information. Anybody can go in and see what the values of land is in that particular township anytime, but that data comes from recorded sales, which takes some time to get into the mix. So this is the proposed payment structure based on estimated market value, but estimated market value is really a proxy for what we refer to as cash rent for the land.
Mr. Dashkin, Representative Doty. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not finished with all the quick math on this. It seems like the number of acres that we could possibly get easements from out of $3.3 million that's also going to be used to continue the work of the committee and other things is a really small number of acres. I'm looking at the numbers just from the ethanol plant in my district at Little Falls, and they can use 102,000 tons for one process and 150,000 tons for another process. There isn't close to enough money in this recommendation to get easements to do any pilot project, is it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Doty, the $3 million would certainly be not many pilot projects, but probably one pilot project, and certainly this easement program without any source of biomass or a facility. It's intended to stimulate interest and then availability in landowners to convert their existing crop to something else that could be more sustainable from an environmental point. That's one goal of it. But again, whether you could, right, I would use your calculation. You're probably looking at 1,000 acres, based on the numbers that we're looking at.
I'm great, that's great. The number I got.
I'm great for me. Your math is as good as mine. The facility you're referring to, I'm very familiar with. That's right. They could use more than that, but they may be able to get some other sources as well. And people have been looked at, using corn silver and even woody mass and things like that. But this industry, what I do know about it, which is probably not as much as many others do, it's still in its infancy. We're still exploring where it's going to go and how it's going to go. The idea here was to stimulate landowners to be able to have a payment, basically a 20-year conservation easement, which reflects the cash rental rate really for that land to grow something else besides the traditional commodity crop. So that's the general gist of it. So I think your calculation is correct, and it's a very small number. We look at the total demand any particular larger plant like that one would potentially take on. And there's probably other folks here who can speak better to this that are going to be up testifying
Representative Salzy's
bill, so maybe I'll defer to their input.
Representative Billy. Mr. Chair and Mr. Jaskie, it seems to me that given how closely I've worked with many of the farmers that send their product to the existing ethanol plant there, that the incentive here to bring in enough people in any district to do this, if you do one pilot project, even 1,000 acres, it just seems like we are woefully inadequate on this number if we're really serious about doing a demonstration project. And I would hope that somehow we're going to look for enough money to do a real project. I think we have a wonderful goal here. I think it fits in not just this committee's plans for things as we've gone through things the last couple of years, but it also fits within what the industry wants to do. And if we're going to help it along the way, it seems like we could use about more quick math, maybe four times as much money to even do a project very well. So I hope there's some way to do that rather quickly. It's a good idea. I don't think we can do that. And Mr. Chair, I have one unrelated question to that too, and I've hopefully made what I think is a good strong point. I'm biased, you grew up around there, these small farms, if they have an incentive to make some money, they will probably actually produce this stuff. That'd be wonderful. It would keep the people in the area, it would give us clean fuel, it would reduce the carbon footprint, it would do many magnificent things. But I don't think we can do it for this amount of money. The other thing is, are we looking at this one now? Before we talk about the lifetime easement versus 20-year easements, are you going to make these guys go lifetime? Because it might scare a lot of them off.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, a couple points. One is, these would be intended to be 20-year easements to get them stimulated. And if the industry is going to grow like some think it can, at some point you're not going to need them. They won't need the conservation easement because the payment from the biofuel facility will be sufficient to sustain their interest in producing native grass. That's the idea, I think, long term. To your earlier point about the amount of money, this program was designed to accommodate, small amount or a large amount of funding, and it was also designed to accommodate funding from a variety of sources. It could be the bonding bill, obviously, is what we're talking about today, but if the Federal Farm Bill were to generate some funding for this same kind of endeavor, or some other source were identified, and certainly these payments to these landowners would be supplemented very likely by the biofuel production facility. These are just a base payment, and then the plant would go out and negotiate contracts with landowners to pay them, additional amounts to get that biofuel committed to their facility, because they would be able to otherwise use it for other purposes, potentially. So the really new piece of this is that the biofuel production facility is central to making it work. but even more fundamental, as you described, is getting landowners interested in committing to it. And that's what this is about, is getting them in a kind of an insurance policy that even if the facility doesn't pan out, because you never know, there would be a conservation easement that the state benefits could be, you know, justified because of the conservation gain. But the fuel would put out, maybe a bonus, basically, that the plant could pay for. That's the concept, and again, we'll have others come up here, I'm sure, after I'm finished and talk with you more eloquently about it than I can, because they have been involved in it from the beginning. So,
Mr. Chair, I think I want to make sure that my point isn't missed here. I think we have a great opportunity, a great idea, and not enough money to make it work.
Mr. Jaffe, I'm looking on page 19, and it talks about a maximum payment of 105% of estimated market value. So let me be clear on this. For a 20-year easement, you would be paying more than the value of the land if it was purchased, and there would be a payment by the ethanol company for the product.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's correct. However, the EMV is it's not the actual value. It's the value based on average sales from a couple of years ago. So what you really got to look at that is that that's a cash rental rate that we'd be paying, 105% of cash rental rate is kind of the way I would look at it. Now, we don't have that here because we can't get numbers that are cash rental rate accurate enough. So we have used a more simplified way to do the math, but it was meant to approximate cash rental rates.
Mr. Jaffe, would the rental rate be higher than the value of the land?
No, I don't believe it would be, because these numbers are, again, we're using an EMV from 2 years ago off of a property tax statement, and those are generally lower than the actual values to begin with, and certainly when we're talking about lands that are accelerating in their value, it'll even be more of the case. This is the best estimate across the board that folks felt would entice landowners, and you see that number that's going above 100% is really for those who want to go well beyond the norm and plant very diverse species mix, so they have some additional maintenance and installation responsibilities.
And after 20 years, after the public investment, the land could go back into a different production.
That is correct. The conservation easement would have expired. Okay. Actually, Mr. Chairman, I think that's the end of my presentation on the governor's recommendation.
Mr. Jaffe, I would ask if, because Representative Junkie is unable to be here, and he had the House File 2611. I know it wasn't in the governor's recommendation, but I believe the project did come forward to the agency. If you could maybe just describe the project a little bit. I want to be clear for the record that it's not in the governor's recommendation, but that you have knowledge of it. So you can.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's probably going to Grass Lake, and we've had past appropriations to fund parts of that project. It's a large area, a wetland restoration outside the city of Wilmer, and the past appropriations have gotten to where we've acquired or have rights now to acquire all the land underlying this large, called a lake, called a large-scale wetland, but it's being restored to provide water quality treatment for its habitat and other things. And the remaining amount that's needed to fund to complete the project is about $1.5 million is our estimate. And the need for that funding is to build the structure to divert the water from the city's stormwater system in and through and around this project so that we don't have flooding and we can control the levels and do the water habitat. So for the infrastructure elements now, the land has been acquired.
And does the proposal as it was written, does that involve ditching at all, or is it just construction?
Mr. Chairman, there is a ditch that ran through the wetland, and that's being basically plugged to restore the wetland, but there's also a diversion channel around it that has to be established because of wanting to make sure large flooding events don't back up water into the city's drainage system. So it's the old ditch that drained it is being undone, and a new diversion channel during very high flows is being built around the lake, around the wetland.
Mr. Lyons, do you have anything to add, or you were sitting there patiently?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, there's been several questions by members about the interest from landowners. I think historically the Rim Reserve program has been extremely well received by landowners, in particular the partnership that we're talking about here with the WRP program. And basically what we have here is the two premier wetland restoration programs in the country. WRP is the most significant program that's funded by the federal government through the United States Department of Agriculture. And the Rim Reserve program is, of course, our state easement program, and it's the most successful state easement program. So putting them together, I think what we're really being able to offer is the best of both of those programs and developing competitive payment rates for landowners continue to want to enroll. And we obviously make both agencies and federal and state money go much further, and we can continue the accelerated restoration of wetlands in the state that are so badly needed. So it's a great opportunity. The mechanics specifically of the program are the WRP program, which is taking a 30-year easement for the federal government, and that establishes a specific payment rate that WRP makes. The Rim Reserve program would piggyback on top of that a permanent rim easement and make a payment that would then be providing sufficient compensation to the landowner that they are interested in enrolling in. The need of this has really come in light back in 2006 when the appraisal process for the WRP program was changed. And with that change, what we saw on the landscape level is landowners were not willing to accept a loan. The federal payment was not sufficient. So by partnering together, we then again create a program that's successful. And as John alluded to earlier, that the landowners ultimately determine the success or failure of the program. So it's very important that we create a level of interest from landowners as enrollment continues, because we desperately need additional wetlands and wetland restoration and the associated native grass around us to provide the benefits to the public. So hopefully I've said enough now, Mr. Chairman.
Ryan, you're out there on the ground. You meet with the farmers, you meet with the districts, and just looking back at the flood $1 million, you had no trouble. Did you have any trouble at all on permanent easements with landowners accepting that in the southeast seven counties, where we provided $1 million.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, you know, as John alluded to, the signing period just ended at the end of January. The local our board conservation are prioritizing the enrollment right now. We had $2.1 million that we targeted to that, and I believe we're, as John alluded to, that plus another couple million that was asked for. Obviously, we'll not be able to fund all of that, and those were all permanent easements requested. So the short answer is no, we didn't have any problem in the southeast flood damage area.
Thank you. Any other questions? I note there are some other members who are on the agenda, and I don't want to have them wait a long time. So I see that the Magnus is here, that Amaro, the chair, can wait on his bills. The members go first. And I thought I saw Representative Beard and a Representative Scalzi's here. I know there are some other committees meeting this. Representative Magnus, do you want to?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. Does everyone have a copy of the bill? I know we're on a fast track here. I didn't introduce the bill or bring it up to the hopper yesterday. I've been waiting for some of the members that this affected.
Let me just make sure everybody has it. It's
5362?
Yep. Should have handwritten on there.
There's, Mr. Chairman and members, there's six representatives that represent this area, the Area 2 Minnesota River Basin, so I wanted to have them get an opportunity to sign on the bill before I put it up, but everybody's scrambling here now, so I've got several on it and put the bill up and have others sign on to it. And I do have one pack that I could pass around to, if you want to take a look at it. It describes the Area 2 Minnesota River program, which was started in 1978, in its 30th year now. It's a joint powers agreement with 9 counties in the southwestern area of the state, and those are described in there, and some of the projects are described in there also. When they do the projects, they're leveraged, and that varies from project to project. There's a description under some of the sample projects there on just kind of what leverage fund areas they look at, and they do vary depending on the project, but I think that's an important consideration we should look at when we look at bonding requests in the area. I think you need to look at if it certainly needs to have at least a regional benefit, if not a total statewide benefit to the state. And I believe it should have leveraged funds, and I think those are the two key things that the bonding committee will hopefully look at. The goals of this initiative here in this joint powers agreement with the river, Area 2 River projects are to reduce flooding, and it's been done especially emphasis on that in the early history of the program. Many of you have heard about the flooding history of Montevideo, for example, down in there, and other areas of the state. And so that's been the emphasis on this. Also, we want to keep increasing interest in keeping the sediments and the nutrients on the land and on the headwaters of the Minnesota River. And by doing that, we can better the Minnesota River, and we can better the Mississippi River and on down. I think the history of the program shows that it's an efficient program. Again, it's leveraged funds in several different cases, several different entities, and it's run lean and mean. Last year we came before the committee and got some operating funds. Someone has to design these projects and work on that, and that's been a tradition. One year we come in for some operating funds, and next year we come in and ask for bonding funds to support the program. So that's basically where we're at today. We're asking that for $500,000 from the bonding proceeds. So that's basically the questions.
Any questions?
And I can get an update of those packs of that for members, and I don't have them today, but I certainly will as you go.
Okay.
Because I think it's a great story to tell.
Thank you, Representative Megan.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Good morning.
Good morning, members. This is House File 471. This bill did move through committees last year. Part of it was included in House File 886, Care Housing Bonding Bill. This concerns the Lake Chitmo watershed in Gaylor in Shelby County. And what's going around now is just a very brief portion of the presentations that were made last session. You'll see on the first page the depiction of the Lake Chitmo watershed, one of the largest watersheds in southern Minnesota, heading into Lake Chitmo, which you'll see on the right-hand side, right above the city of Gaylor. It's an 842-acre lake that at one time was a 20-foot deep lake, and is now a 4-foot deep lake. It is because of the sediment coming from left to right across the depiction on the first page. And what we have found in working with the Minnesota State University in Mankato, they look on pages 2, 3, and 4 of the handout. It's that a partnership between the Lake Chitmo Association a citizen group down there. They were dressed in Clinton time this morning. They're led by a principal down there who had to be in the classroom. So you'll see on the depiction, on the second page, the water balance, the sediments, the nutrients, and what's essentially happening is the phosphate and nitrate coming out.
Actually, if you need to move the bill to get it on the table. Gunther?
I'll move House File 471 for possible inclusion in our capital investment bill.
Thank you. Sorry, I just want to make sure to conserve as much of the time as possible. The lake, you'll see under nutrient snapshots, for example, on page 2, the fourth slide. It's essentially happening, especially on an average flow day, that the lake is emitting a tremendous amount of nitrate and phosphate into the Minnesota River watershed, the then empties into the Mississippi and down to the Gulf of Mexico. On a given day, the lake will emit more phosphate and nitrate than the entire city of Gaylord in a month. The water quality is now eutrophic, as depicted on the final slide on page 2. So the City of Gaylord and the Lake Titlow Committee have come up with the following proposal. I do have an office amendment to House File 471.
Did you get that to members?
No, it should be an oral amendment that's changing some of the numbers. And I'm going to start with the good news first, if I may, Mr. Chair, on lines 2.1 to 2.8. This is subdivision 3, referring to tile cover. I spoke with the group down there this week. They would like to now omit lines 2.1 to 2.8 entirely. That was the good news. Now, if we can return here to line 1.7, the committee has asked me to amend at $150,000 to $175,000. This is money to work with MSU Mankato professors and others to pre-design and design holding ponds above the lake before water enters into Lake Titlow. And the rest of the project has been described in previous committee hearings as well. And the final oral amendment would be on line 1.15. The City of Gaylord now has a new city administrator after some time of tension, and I've been told now that the number of $325,000 should be amended to $499,000. This is money that you'll see on the final page of the handout. Lake Titlow has a number of, Gaylord has a number of sewers emptied right into Lake Titlow. You'll see on page 4, underneath the lake, you'll see a number of X's. Those X's depict where the storm sewers enter into the lake directly. The $499,000 would be a part payment. The City of Gaylord would handle the rest to divert the water not from the lake, but to the existing holding treatment pond that you'll see depicted on the right-hand side. That pond has been constructed, it's just not being filled right now. It's a big camp for the sewer line. And then the water goes down to the wetlands or mud lake, depicted at the bottom of the page. And then finally the water follows down toward the Rush River and then toward the lake.
Representative Moore, we need to move that amendment.
So moved.
Representative Anzo, that's moving the change on line 1.7 to 175, 1.15, 325 to 499, and leaving 2.1 to 2.8. Any discussion? Discussion. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. It is adopted.
Okay, good. I will conclude by saying this is an exciting project, very important to the entire watershed area. I'm excited that MSU Mankato is working with local citizens in the community to try to find a way to address problems that not only will help this region, but actually they're going to figure out answers that will be beneficial to the state of Minnesota as we address wetlands and watersheds throughout the state. I have a chance for any questions.
Representative Virginia.
Yes, thank you. Just a comment. I had the opportunity to visit with the bonding committee, and the science being brought by MSU, I am
applicants in will help everybody as they work to complete this project. And this is a learning project as well as a restoration project. We're probably more impressed with this project than, well, I won't say any others, but it was extremely
well done.
I just say it was extremely well done. It's very impressive.
Thank you, Representative Genius. And it is very simple. We've got graduate students and undergraduate students learning how to advance their own learning in water management and wetland. Another exciting part is that MSU Mankato has proceeded on its own in the interim and did receive some grant money from the state in order to buy equipment in order to measure the daily load, because that was one of the factors that was missing. And that was one of the things that we were needed before we could go ahead with the $175,000 pre-design. So the MSU Mankato has been proceeding in other avenues that get funds as well for this very important project. Thank you.
Any other questions? Ben Gunther?
Chairman, I renew my motion to have House File 471 as amended be included in our, possibly included in our capital budget.
Was laid over for possible
improvement. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. And just for the audience, Representative Magnus's bill has not been introduced, so we have not moved that. Should be introduced soon and have a number. We're unable to take amendments or to move that bill because it has not been introduced. Representative that. See, Representative Beard is here. If you want to come forward, I know you have another.
Mr. Chairman, members, I have House File 2738 for your consideration.
Chairman? I will move House File 2738 to pass the inclusion on the bottom.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 2738 is a bill that appropriates bonding money through the DNR to the Lower Minnesota River Watershed District to acquire land, as well as designing construction improvements on that land for a dredge material site. Now, over the past 2 years, some of you in this committee will remember that I've carried a couple bills for the Lower Minnesota River Watershed District as they accomplish and actually execute their mandate for taking care of the river, particularly in this regard for the commerce that happens, particularly from Mafo 21 down to the junction with the Mississippi. One of the most important points for commerce for the state of Minnesota is the connection of the Minnesota River to the Mississippi River, which of course is one of our major national waterways. This connection is essential for moving commerce via barges from businesses and agriculture entities throughout Minnesota, particularly in the western and southwestern portions of the state. In order for barges to be able to connect to Minnesota and the Mississippi or vice versa, a 9-foot navigational channel must be maintained. And that's where the Corps of Engineers and the Minnesota Watershed, the Lower Minnesota River Watershed District interconnect. This channel extends from the confluence with the Mississippi near Fort Snelling down to Savage. Actually, they may not maintain 9 feet. There is a provision not referred to here today that maintains 4 feet to the city of Shakopee. In order to maintain the 9-foot channel, the Lower Minnesota River Watershed District must provide the Corps of Engineers with sites for the placement of the dredge material in this corridor. We just can't pump it onto the shore or into a wetland anywhere, so it is incumbent on the district to actually provide sites where they can take the dredge material, treat it, and then dispose of it. Oftentimes this material is reused in other capacities, mostly for reapplication or mixing in topsoil. Without state bonding, now to be fair, without state bonding, the Lower Minnesota Watershed District could use its levy authority and would be forced actually to use its levy authority to tax the constituents within the district. That would include even just the individual homeowners. But we believe, because of its statewide implications, that it's appropriate for the state to assist with costs associated in these activities. Because of its statewide implication, I think it meets the test for bonding instead of taxing the local citizens. Today I'm happy to have Glenn Kramer with me. He's the president of Lower Minnesota Watershed District, and Terry Schwalbe, who's behind me, is the administrator, and I may slide aside and let Terry assist Glenn as they talk to you about the project today and give you some more details.
Mr. Kramer, if you could introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to talk about the 9-foot navigation channel that we made the Minnesota River Watershed District is a local sponsor for a federal project. Recently, we were asked by the Corps of Engineers who maintains that channel to acquire from the district site to dredge oil in Florida. The reason for that is that there is increasing sediment load in the river that are being caused by increased runoff as the result of the changing agricultural land uses in the upstream watershed. Unfortunately, we're a very small watershed, 80 square miles at the bottom of a 15,000 square mile Minnesota River watershed. And as the agricultural practices change from growing alfalfa and from using their land for pasture to corn and soybeans, the runoff increases. There's more riverbank erosion, and unfortunately, we're the recipient of about 250,000 tons of sediment every year. And about 20 to 40% of that sediment settles out in our river channel and in our floodplain lakes. And so it puts a significant burden on the watershed district. As I indicated, we're only an 80 square mile area, and historically the responsibility for those costs have been on the residents and industries in that watershed. Disposal sites are getting much harder to find. They're more expensive. Operating costs are much greater, and we feel that because of the significant benefits to the state of Minnesota, that there should be some state cost sharing in this with this problem. Been about a little over three million tons of grain and aggregate and other products shipped on the river. It's the most inexpensive way to ship agricultural products, so it's a significant benefit to the ag industry in the Minnesota River watershed. It reduces traffic on your highways, so that's a significant benefit. And we are asking legislation for cost participation in that project.
Mr. Kramer, the bill mentions about acquiring land. Do you have a willing seller?
Yes, we do. And so our responsibility is to acquire and develop the site, so it's ready for the core.
And is the $225,000, is that the total cost, or is that are you matching that with a levy?
There's a significant amount of local money that's also used. In addition, the Watershed District provides the operating funds to operate the site. So we acquire the site, develop the site, and then operate the site and dispose of the material that the core deposits in the site. So there's a significant amount of local funds that go into it, even with this gas line that might be available.
Any other questions? Any other summary? Or
I guess in summary, and there is a summary sheet on your in the packet that I sent you. Like I indicated earlier, we've got 15,000 square miles of agricultural land that is the principal cause of our problem, and we are only 80 square miles of area that is historically been responsible for the financial solution of the problem. We feel that there are significant economic benefits for the state that justify state participation, and the state does provide capital money to some of the other ports, the Port of Minneapolis, the Port of St. Paul, the Port of Monona,
in the Port of Duluth, and we feel that there should be some capital money provided for the pork chop. For Savage.
Any questions?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, the members, thanks for letting me make this presentation today. Just noticing with all Mr. Grant making comments that the lower 80 square miles is the transport jumping off point for the other 18,000 square miles that grows all this stuff and sends it down to it, or brings fertilizer inbound to those 18,000 square miles and do the things that they do when they farm and feed a significant portion of the nation and the world. So the Minnesota River watershed, particularly the lower Minnesota, it's a working river, it's a recreational river, it's an important part of our watershed, and we move the stormwater out of the area, and of course this is life goes on. But it is a unique one in that we also have to maintain it. Things that happen upstream, well, we just fix it. It's kind of the recycling of life, I guess, and pull the dirt out of the river and send it back up the river on a truck and put it back on the field. And hopefully we'll find a better way to keep it there. I think you've got an interesting proposal coming up in a moment that might talk about that. But this one, I think, merits your attention and your consideration as you look at bonding money and how we can help them continue to do their job, do it well, help them do it better than we used to in the past. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I renew my motion to have House File 2738 to be possibly included in Environment Finance's capital investment report.
President Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My bill as well does not have a number yet, but you have it in your packet, so you could refer to the revising number, which is 08-5355. And the portion that we will be addressing is would be lines 6.15 through line 6.21. And then we also have two amendments that we will be proposing, and they're including in your packet. The revisor number on those amendments are 808-1099 and 808-1100. And I understand that you can't move this today because we don't have a number, so we'll make the presentation just as the policy that works before your committee. I did want to briefly state what these amendments are for. The 1099 would allow Bowser some flexibility to use to fit within the requirements for federal leveraging of funds. And the Amendment 08-1100 would target the easements to the critical lands that provide the most benefits. So that's a brief explanation of what those are.
President Scalzi, I don't think members have both of those amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is an exciting bill. This is part of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership bill that's being presented this year. As we know, the Minnesota Environmental Partnership is 80-plus organizations that represent a half of a million Minnesotans. This portion of the bill relates to cellulosic bioenergy, and I look on it as the start of the market. We know that in future years this is going to be where we're headed, and I think the previous presenters, Representative Beard, did a good job of sort of telling us why we have to do what we have to do with cellulosic plant material, because these are marginal lands. And these are marginal lands that could be put into corn production with the prices that we're seeing. but these are marginal lands that we would like to replant the prairie on. And these lands also contribute to impaired waters. And if we can stop the runoff on these marginal lands before they get to wetlands, we will accomplish a great deal for the future of Minnesota. These are long-term easements. And the farmers would actually plant this and manage it, as Mr. Jaskin so greatly explained to you. They would be able to continue farming in a way that would be sustainable for all of us in Minnesota. And Representative Doty did a good job explaining that farmers do want to stay on the land. I grew up on a farm, and frankly, if my parents had been presented something like this, this would have been a wonderful opportunity. And it keeps the property on the tax roll, which I think is important to our local community. This proposal has been worked with Bowser, partnering with Bowser and all the locals, and it would produce jobs because the farmers could stay on their land, could plant prairie grasses. It would produce jobs with the prairie seed companies, and it would help us all as we move toward cellulosic bioenergy. We've worked with Ducks Unlimited, Minnesota Waterfowl Association, of which you have a letter in your packet. They probably won't testify unless you have questions for them. They've also worked with Pheasants Forever, Audubon, and Isaac Walton Lake. So this would protect nesting areas, and we know that wetlands are important, but for waterfowl production, we also need the nesting lands which are near the wetlands. So anyway, I'll keep my remarks to that, and then I'll turn it over to Don Arnofsky, who's representing us here from the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. So would you...
Mr. Arnofsky.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Don Arnofsky, and I represent both the Agriculture Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, where I work, and all the members of Clean Energy Minnesota and the Minnesota Environmental Partnership who are supporting this bill. We have today before us an opportunity, I think, that is unlike many of the opportunities that you are presented for funding. We're asking here for a transformative investment, an investment that really will affect the $1 trillion global energy industry, the $1 trillion global agricultural industry, both of which are showing cracks in their old systems. We just heard Representative Beard talk about one of the impacts in the existing agricultural industry, the downstream impacts, the need to dig out and re-truck soil back to our landscape. That is not sustainable. We recognize that global energy systems and global agricultural systems are at a pivot point today. This pivot won't last forever. There is a unique opportunity to move forward and present and create sustainable systems in both energy and agriculture, and the RIM Clean Energy Program is designed to take advantage of this opportunity in time and move forward with that. Lying before you, the RIM Clean Energy is like a newly birthed program, and we're asking for your care. We're asking for you to breathe some life into this program that is 2 years in the development and has had many parents. Representative Scalzi mentioned many of the agricultural groups that we've had involved in the report that you had presented earlier. You mentioned the Farmers Union, the Farm Bureau, Land Stewardship Project, Minnesota Project. We've had conservation groups, as Representative Scalzi pointed out. We've had business groups, including agricultural processing, ethanol, and seed producers, and a number of those folks are here to testify to you today, and they've traveled some distance to present the business opportunities. So why today and why now? Well, we've got trouble in River City. The first generation of biofuels, which, by the way, was designed here in Minnesota and rolled out, it really was not designed to do what people are pretending it should be doing today. It was designed to raise farmers' incomes, and it's worked. It's worked in spades. That's really why it was rolled out 20 to 25 years ago. Now it's being sold as a global warming and an energy security system. And we know that that does not hold up to either scientific scrutiny or economic scrutiny. We understand that this system of first-generation biofuels amped up on steroids is creating tremendous destruction. Globally, European demand for biodiesel, for example, is decimating tropical rainforests. So, for example, the tiny country of Malaysia last year was, I believe it was the third largest, one of the very largest CO2 emitters on the planet as a result of demand for biodiesel in Europe, which is cutting down and burning their peatlands for planting for oil palm plantations for making biodiesel. It's rolling back the Amazon. Soy and sugar cane are moving into areas of the Amazon which are being cleared, and recent studies that were published just in the last week have indicated that it will take generations to recover the carbon releases that are occurring from these cleared lands by use of the first generation biofuels that they're being used for. Closer to home, here in Minnesota, we have our own version of that. And our corn ethanol industry, with the high prices of corn and the high prices being offered in this boom and rush mentality, has resulted in plowing up of CRP contracts, including early buyouts. Some landowners are buying out of the contract they've made for temporary conservation. We have farmers planting into the ditches and up to the roads in contravention of state law, but nevertheless it's occurring. And I had yesterday two different legislators, as we were discussing this program, independently just bring up this issue to me. Will this do anything about the plowing into the ditches and planting corn right through the ditches and right up to the fields and right up to the road edges, in the road right of ways? The very, very high bubbly prices that we are seeing are unsustainable. And every farmer involved in it knows that. The strongest defenders of corn ethanol in this state know that this is a frothy time that will not last. That the ordinary market forces will bring a lot more corn to bear in the market, and the prices will come down. In the meantime, though, we're having food markets disrupted worldwide. Our livestock industry is suffering. Cost of food is going up. Bread and milk have greatly increased because of the biofuels, the first generation annual crop biofuels displacing food. Wheat was $3 to $5 historically, is now $11 or $15, and I heard one person tell me it hit $20 in the last week, $20 a bushel. Soy has more than doubled to over $10 a bushel. Corn, which has recently been $2 to $3, is over $5. Well, rural Minnesota is riding high right now. Farmers are making good incomes. They're certainly covering their cost of production. And what's wrong with that? We have a $5 billion industry. We have 18,500 jobs in Minnesota, direct and indirect, in the ethanol industry. And, of course, that is benefiting many people in rural Minnesota short term. However, as I said, it's unstable. The savings and loan debacle of the 1980s, the dot bombs of the 1990s, the Enrons and WorldCom financial manipulations of the 2000s, and frankly, the authors of the subprime mortgage speculations that are imploding the economy today, those folks are rushing into first-generation biofuel plants right now. They're rushing into them here in Minnesota and around our region and around our country. Last year, federal subsidies and high energy prices allowed a developer of a 100 million gallon ethanol plant to pay off that plant in 1 to 2 years. You folks know this. You know our need to change. You know that we are riding an unsustainable bubble. Rural Minnesota communities are going to ride a whipsaw down. So we must adapt or face a crash in rural Minnesota. So I bring you back again to the Spring Clean Energy Program. This is a program that is designed to leverage agriculture and energy. These are multi-trillion dollar industries nationwide and multi-billion dollar industries locally. Visionary leaders, again here in Minnesota, have put down the next generation of biofuels, the blueprint here that addresses all these issues. We've incorporated local science and global businesses as partners here. I'll mention, Representative Doty mentioned his ethanol plant, Central Minnesota Ethanol in Little Falls. They were the first in our region to put in the next generation of fuels. They put in a gasifier to use biomass to power their corn ethanol facility, and they've announced a partnership to directly make ethanol out of woody biomass with another company that will be working with them. Central Chippewa Valley Ethanol Cooperative, a 900-member cooperative in the Benson area. Bill Lee, who's their president, would have been here today, but they're actually inaugurating and doing test firing of their gasifier to convert from fossil fuels to cellulosic materials. That's happening today, this week, in Benson, Minnesota. Rar Malting is a company that has formed Coda Energy in partnership with the Madwakaden Sioux, and you're going to have a presentation shortly about the status of that. These are businesses that have made investments, that have moved forward to bet on the future. They are working in partnership to avoid the damaging impacts that we know are all out there. Dozens of small businesses stand by, ready to assist with the seed planting, the cultivation, the prairie restoration, the harvest and transport. We have three representatives that will come up as a panel to talk to you about their ability to create jobs now and to respond and use native seeds and locally provenance seeds in planting these easements. We have many nonprofit partners who are offering technical assistance, education, and organizing. You have a letter from the Minnesota Environment, I'm sorry, the Minnesota Project in your packet that was distributed. And they are working, for example, with Rar Malting to connect them with farmers in the lower Minnesota River Valley who are interested in planting sustainable perennial crops. It's time to put a footprint on the ground to make this Minnesota model not a stillborn baby lying on the sidewalk. Representative Doty, you're exactly right. 1,000 acres is hardly a pilot demonstration in even one area. We need statewide impact. We need national impact. We're asking for a crowbar to move these industries, not a toothpick. We need a lever. We need a significant investment to change the energy and agricultural industries. You've heard how the program works before. John Jasky explained it to you, and Representative Scalzi did as well. We're asking you to support a Minnesota model that will be sustainable biofuels, the second generation. It's going to build soil carbon. It will clean up our impaired rivers. It will provide a habitat and protect nesting birds. It will provide fuel for the next generation of bioenergy. It will create new jobs directly, and perhaps even more importantly, it can save rural Minnesota from the crash that is inevitably coming from the overdependence on unsustainable first-generation biofuels. We are asking you to make a double-digit, multi-million dollar investment to be a significant enough money so that we can go to Washington and ask the federal programs that in real time, some of our same organizations have been working directly with representatives in Washington who are working on the federal farm program. And it's no coincidence that there are complementary packages that are under consideration in the conference committee right now under the Farm Bill. And we're looking to position Minnesota to capture some of those matching dollars. That's the intention of one of those amendments that was in front of you, to allow the Board of Water and Soil Resources to respond to however the Washington scene unfolds to capture the maximum value. The last point I would like you to make before we bring up the other testifiers is, if I could refer you to this packet that John Jasky distributed to you. And he showed you how the wetland reserve and the critical habitat, grim critical habitat, the Rim Reserve Program would work together to save critical lands that should never be in agricultural production and they should be under permanent easement. This program is designed to be complementary, not competitive with that. This is designed to enhance the ecological value of these preserved core lands, as you might see here, by taking surrounding fields, as you can observe in that picture, to keep them in agricultural production, but to keep them in perennial cover, native perennial cover, which will provide upland nesting habitat for the birds, enhance and reduce the infiltration and the runoff into these wetlands, really enhance the investment that the public is making in permanent protection in these core preserved areas. This is the next tier of lands. It's not targeting the same lands. It's targeting agricultural land. We have 25 million acres of plowed ground in this state today. We need 5 million acres of it in perennial grassland cover if we're ever going to get out of our impaired water situation, if we're ever going to clean up our waters and provide our wildlife habitat. This is an economic model to work with farmers and revive these industries, and I ask you to make a significant investment in it. Thank you very much for your consideration. I would ask Paul Kramer, who's the president of Coda Energy and the vice president of Rademalti.
Before we go, President Gunter has a question.
Yes.
Mr. Hinesky, I appreciate your testimony and your enthusiasm very much.
Thank you.
Look at the potential for corn ethanol. If we planted every acre in corn, we would have enough to probably replace 12.5% of fossil fuels we use. However, there are plants that could be used as a third crop. I would like to know your opinion of having a third crop of, let's say, macantus, that yields 17 times more per acre of ethanol than corn does. Is that something that your group would embrace?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Gunter, Clean Energy Minnesota has embraced this program, which is designed to maximize public benefits while at the same time provide productive energy crops. What you described is a non-native plant that is highly productive in certain situations in Minnesota soils, and that certainly would provide high levels of biomass, which could be converted to energy. We have focused this program and our support today on a program that we think is a little more balanced across the board, that provides habitat for native wildlife, that will clean up our waters, which indeed planting this canthus in place of corn would also do. We're not saying that there wouldn't be some of these benefits available, but we think it's more balanced to support the native ecosystem and bring back a mixture of crops. We believe under changing climate, which we are facing today with global change, a diverse mixture of native species provides the farmer the opportunity to have his field respond, whether he's facing drought or flood, whether we're having early season or late season frost or green up, and having a diverse mixture is actually using native knowledge that is inherent in our plant species to make sure that we're not winding up with crops that perhaps wind up with off years. So it's perhaps a less focused only on energy and more focused on a diversity of benefits is the program that we are looking at.
Thank you. Mr. Anasi, to follow up on that, Mr. Jasky had mentioned that 1 acre in native prairie would produce 4 to 5 tons of product. How many tons of product does 1 acre corn produce? How many tons of grain? How many tons of silver?
Mr. Hansen, you're better able to answer that question than I am, and actually in my head I don't have the answer, so perhaps there's another person in the room, but I'm not an expert on corn production rates.
Maybe we'll get someone else who can answer that. We'll move to the Coda Energy.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Paul Kramer with the Rademalti Company. I'm also president of Coda Energy. I have a handout here. I basically want to just spend a few minutes giving you an update on what Coda Energy is and then talk a little bit about what we see as the real environmental benefits of dedicated energy crops with a little reflection on what Rademalti has done in the past. Coda Energy, located in Shakopee, Minnesota, 100% biomass-fired combined heat and power plant. Construction's underway. It'll be starting December of this year. It's a $55 million project. It's a private investment from the two partners. The biomass that we're going to be using for our facility is going to replace the use of natural gas at the Rar Malting Company facility. We're going to generate two products, 16.5 megawatts of base load electricity, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and that's equivalent to the use of 14,000 homes, so it's a significant amount of electricity. And just as important, that elimination of natural gas is going to provide Rar Malting 125 million BTU an hour of heat for the malting process, and that's equivalent to the use of natural gas 11,000 homes. So you can see that little facility we have is like a small city in terms of the amount of carbon that it's using right now. Coda's going to create some high-paying jobs. We're going to have 11 employees and $900,000 annual payroll. There's going to be other jobs that will be generated with the logistics of a biomass system. We're talking to people in Scott County right now about a biomass fuel processing facility. So there's going to be other jobs that will be spun off well beyond what we have here. Coda Energy needs biomass. We need 174,000 tons of biomass a year. I mean, the chickens here, we're looking for the eggs now, because we need some dedicated energy crops. We weren't naive enough to say that the grasses exist right now. We based our model on our byproducts from our malting process, other agribusiness byproducts from agribusiness dust, drain dust, also dried wood. But our long-term goal is to have 15% to 30% of our fuel as a dedicated energy crop that we would contract with farmers. And the reason we look at that is we thought it would be very easy to get 8,000 to 15,000 acres of marginal land along the Minnesota River, where we are located right next to the Minnesota River, and put those into grasses that would do the environmental benefits that we see. Obviously, we're going to pay for the biomass. I mean, we anticipate that our annual expenditures will be over $6.5 million a year for these biomass products to the farmers and to the other companies that provide it. And again, this is going to be a local 50-mile radius. The RIMCE program, we think, is just a perfect solution to jumpstart this. I mean, obviously, the environmentally sustainable low-input energy crops and marginal lands, you've heard that from everyone else here. I don't want to go into that too much, but it's real. It definitely is real. But we need to begin the process of dedicated energy crop production. The problems we see is that we're out there, we're going to be someone that can use it, but farmers, are concerned because there's a couple of us now that are out there, the Benson plant, our plant. They need to have some additional incentive to show that it can work. I think this could be a good example. We'll contract, again, long-term contracts, because when you plant an energy crop, you're planting an investment for a fair amount of time. So we'll give long-term contracts for and security to the farmers. Environmentally, the benefits of what will happen with these products is tremendous. Just from our project alone, Coda Energy, we're going to have 70,000 tons a year of reduced carbon dioxide from not burning natural gas. We'll have 180,000 tons a year less CO2 than a 16.5 megawatts of coal generation would generate for electrical. Also, you can think of the other projects that will use this. Tremendous carbon offsets. And right now, carbon offsets have a value. Right now, Xcel Energy in their 2007 plan that they put a figure at $9 a ton. So you look at that. I mean, there's some real dollars here that involved with carbon. The other thing I'd like to just dwell upon. We heard about the issue with the river bottoms and for our malting. We've done a lot of projects that we think are environmentally responsible. We did a creative trading project for our wastewater treatment plant in 1997. Instead of getting lawyers and try to sue for the rights to go into the river, we worked with the PCA and tried to come up with plans for trading. And we came up with a very interesting plan that the PCA worked on, did all the calculations on, and part of what we traded for was clean up the Minnesota River through non-point source improvements. Two of our projects were a total of 85 acres that we took that were marginal row crop land along the river, converted them into trees and natural grasses. Same type of thing we'd be talking about here. The PCA looked at that and said that's worth 100 pounds of phosphorus, and that's equivalent to the discharge of a 1 million gallon wastewater treatment plant. Now, if you scale it up and you say you got 10,000 acres on similar marginal land, which is certainly a lot of the Minnesota River Valley, that's 11,700 pounds of phosphorus reduction to the river. The issue with the Gulf of Mexico and phosphorus in Lake Pepin, I mean, it's a regional, local and regional issue. I mean, that would be equivalent to the discharge from a $300 million wastewater treatment plant, if you looked at the scope. So that's real. Obviously, the habitat improvement of having grasses, because again, we're talking about just one cut a year, fall cut. The other thing I'd like to say is I'd really like to also say this is a keep money in Minnesota program, because every 1,000 acres you put in to these energy crops would yield at today's cost of natural gas about $600,000. Right now, that $600,000 is going somewhere out of the state to buy natural gas. That would stay here. So for me, there's almost a 4-to-1 benefit for every dollar put into this program over the 20-year period. $4 will stay in the state because that fuel is going to be used here. So again, I'd like to say these plants are real. You can see the picture of our facility. It's well under construction. We're starting up, and the demand is there. I think we just need some assistance to plant the seed of energy crops. So thank you very much.
Any questions?
And then next.
Thank you. Next up, sir.
Mr. Chairman, we have three members of the native seed and prairie restoration industry here. Joe Schaefer, who's the president of Minnesota Native Landscapes from Foley, Minnesota, and John Gary, who's the vice president, and then Ron Bowen, who's the founder and president of Prairie Restoration Inc. from Princeton, Minnesota. They're all here to tell you about how they can respond and make this a real opportunity and real job in short order.
Welcome. We'll go first. The one in the middle goes first.
We're glad to be here, Chairman and committee. We are competitors and friends, have worked in the industry for collectively, I would say, probably 50 or 60 years. Our company is 31 years old now.
If you could state your name.
And Ron Bowen from Prairie Restoration Incorporated, Princeton. We have six locations, Princeton is one, employ up to 100 people in the summer, and make our living basically restoring prairies and wetlands and some woodland work statewide and even beyond Minnesota, but essentially Minnesota. We produce seed, and I think that one of the concerns that we have here today is whether there would be enough seed, enough local origin seed in particular, to plant all these acres that we hear being talked about. And I know from our perspective, Prairie Restoration Incorporated, we feel that if the carrot is out there, we can ratchet that up fairly quickly. And, you know, I'll speak to a little bit to this and then try and let Joe and John get in here. But it's very important when we talk about local origin seed. And I know Representative O'Kane has spent a lot of time on this. Local origin seed means, you know, generally within, say, 50 miles. You can draw those circles however big you really want. But our seed, and I think speaking for other producers, many of the other producers as well, have collected seed from remnant populations so that we have local gene pool material. This is an important part of the strategy. I think if we looked at the whole state and all the seed that's out there and, you know, various farms and producers that have made this seed and really isolated the local origin seed, we'd find that there's a lot of it and could be, certainly the nucleus is there so that it could be ratcheted up in two or three years to quite a bit more. I really feel that we can supply, as we've talked about in this small group, 12 or 13,000 acres of planting and the seed for that probably this year and certainly next year if we know about this. So again, the carrot will make a difference. I should be quiet for a minute and give it over to Joe.
Good morning, committee members. Mr. Chair, my name is Joe Schaefer. I'm president of a company called Minnesota Native Landscapes out of Foley, Minnesota. We're in our 10th year right now. We are an ecological restoration company that restores habitats and native plant communities. We also produce seed and native plant materials and offer, you know, land management services for the projects that we install. It's an interesting combination to get us at the same table with Ron, but
the camera.
But we're willing to do it today because we've been asked to come and testify or maybe answer questions on the preparedness or ability of our industry to deliver on something like this. And as Ron said, we feel pretty strongly that we are. We've kind of looked at the RIM Clean Energy project or bill, as Ron was saying, on 12 or 13,000 acre scale, and have projected that for sure by 2010, you know, spring of 2010, we could, you know, use, with using native local origin materials, we could have that many acres in the ground. As you know, us and Prairie Restoration come to this issue from two different aspects. One is the seed production, opportunities, if you want to call it that. But also, we look at it from an ecological standpoint and how this idea of using grasslands or native grassland material as an energy source has a lot of potential, and it has a lot of potential to be really good and also at the same time really bad for the environment and the ecosystems, the natural ecosystems of Minnesota. And so that's why we're very supportive of what the RIM Clean Energy proposal is, to use local ecotype diverse native plant materials to establish these biofuels. The alternative is using other species that could be perennial and could provide some of the same energy benefits, but also could be harmful to the native plant ecosystems that are out there. And so that's why we support the use of the local origin stuff. And we feel like that it's often talked about, is there enough seed out there? And again, we're here today mostly to show you that on a timely basis, we do feel that we could produce, the industry as a whole could produce enough seed to really ramp this up. You start with small quantities, you expand fields, and in a number of short years, you can have quite a bit of seed material. So I'll pass it over to John.
I don't want to reiterate too much, but you hit it pretty good. This setting, I feel like I should be telling you, I've never had used green growth hormone or something. But,
the Bill guys hit it pretty good, but I'll say that the aspect of our industry's outlook is there is a lot of medium-sized and small growers across the state that I think are waiting to step it up, are looking for that carrot, and if the parameters are set where we all know what the field is, if it's 50 miles and what the locations are, we can meet those needs as an industry, I think. But it has to happen now. I mean, somebody in the upper Midwest is going to get their hands on this, and if it's not us and we don't have direction, it's hard to do without knowing the market's going to be there. And that said, I think it's fairly important for companies like ours, some that are not represented here, that you have this intersection of the economy and the environment, and it doesn't happen very much, and it certainly doesn't happen at the start of a market like this where it can benefit many different parties, from an environmental standpoint, plus help the market as big as energy. So that said, I think if you guys have any questions, we can answer them. I just remember, that we're ready to go.
Any questions? Representative Doty.
Mr. Chair, were you in the locker room with Roger Clemens when you
were
I wanted to know what that felt like, too.
Okay.
I'd like to just add a little bit, and that is, again, the number of jobs in this industry right now, I would say, is probably relatively small. It's certainly measured in a few hundred. The opportunity to expand that in terms not just of restoration projects, but I look at restoration in two different ways. Historically, it's been sort of aesthetic-based. People planted prairies or wetlands, for various landscape or aesthetic motives. We've moved into, and we're going to continue to move more into, what I call functional restoration. Functional restoration meaning shoreline stabilization, wetland water conservation, and in the case of biomass, certainly biomass production. So this is not about looking pretty. It's really about very functional and important, I think really valuable, in this case, energy, part of the energy solution. Yes, we want diversity in these plantings. I've talked to various players over the last few years about this, and I'm disappointed when I hear 16 species mixes. The real prairies had 300 species on an acre the size of a football field. We need more diversity if we could get it. Now, that doesn't automatically translate into more money. It could be just a more diverse mix for the same money. So again, I would encourage you, if you get down at that level of discussion and the technical aspects of this, that we do look at diversity. 16 is very low in my opinion. I'd like to see more than that. And this will have a very much of a ripple effect in creating more jobs, whether those jobs are technical in terms of planting or managing these sites. I think that the enrolled landowners will need some management services, which will go on and on and on. And that
service industry will blossom. I'm very positive of that. So, again, just a little bit further thought.
I do have a question on that point, and I'm going to cross jurisdictions a little bit with the committee, because we have a lot of land that's under the DNR authority, whether it's wildlife management areas or parkland, and some of that land may have been purchased a while ago and needs restoration. In addition, there may be FNA acres that have remnant prairies where there could be harvest in areas where you may not have a local feed source. So restoration, if we are, and I noticed Representative Salvey's bill, there's a few million dollars for WMA acquisition and FNA acquisition, et cetera, that does that also provide an opportunity for you, both in providing an idea of feedstock you don't have, but the restoration ability to convert some of these acres from maybe green canary grass into back into prairie?
Well, thanks. Here I'll go. The original, I think, part of what you're asking, Mr. Chair, is that the original origin of these materials and where we get that is important. And currently in the state of Minnesota, out of 18 million original acres of prairie, for example, we're down to roughly 100 or 150,000 acres. It's not very many that are left. We need to turn to those remnant parcels and gather the original seed. Now, much of that work has been done. Our company has been doing that for 30 years. And other companies as well. So we have collected from some of those sites. On the other hand, there are still voids in the state. When you look at the state of Minnesota and you look at the seed that's available and where it came from, actually I had hoped that the DNR would have done this last summer, and I don't think they got it done, but I had suggested that they really go out to the producers, really collect the data. The Minnesota Crop Improvement Association has some of this, but I would really suggest that on a relatively brief inventory of what's available, one could fill out the map, see where the voids are, and in those situations where the voids are, WMAs could be of great importance for initial seed collection. I don't think it's a good long-term solution for providing biomass. The biomass should be produced in fields. Landowners, farmers, should produce that biomass. But to get some of the initial seed that might still be needed, that there is a possibility for a partnership there, a public-private partnership.
Can I address?
Sure, why don't we?
You know, as I mentioned before, the parameters are set and genetics are extremely important to our industry. If, you know, 1,000 acres is not a very big pilot program, but even if you said 20,000 acres and we need to seed in this area of the state, there's more out there than you think that either somebody has or resources that we have of people we know that have remnant prairies or have the, you know, basically first generation genetic seed that we could use, get, collect to support that. However, it needs to happen now, so in 2 years it's available.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are several bills traveling this year. One of them is the LCCMR bill, and in that bill, more money was potentially allocated to DNR to do prairie work that I think would fit in with what you all are talking about. I mean, I can't remember the number exactly right now, but DNR had asked for about $900,000 and with more money than that. So there is more potential for seed sharing because we understand that. But there's another bill too, is what I'm telling you.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's another opportunity that's sitting out there in another bill.
To bring it back to Bowser, and we also, REM is a mature program, regular REM. And so we have acres that are out there. Mr. Jaski, is there an existing law requirement for management of acres where there can be harvest?
Mr. Chairman, members, the River Reserve law allows for some harvesting of those lands as long as it doesn't compromise wildlife habitat and water quality.
benefits that seasons were taken for. So, yes, they can, with landowner permission, obviously, because they are part of private land.
So, if we harvested now, this summer, or these plants, there could be restoration opportunities, and there would be the ability in the RIM bonding dollars for restoration to pay for reseeding or overseeding with native seeds on RIM acres that may have non-native vegetation.
Mr. Chairman, I think you're onto something there. I think we'll look at it more carefully, that what defines restoration. I think that's one of the things that I had our staff looking at, what overseeding is and how it's done, so we can make a determination about whether that's a restoration activity or a maintenance activity. I believe it could fall into the category.
It's very important to look at the origin of those fields. Many of those fields are planted as what we call varietals, so they're really not the true local, you know, bean plasm. So you would have to look at the planting history and try and determine where that seed came from when those fields were planted. I think many of them would not fall under the criteria that we're trying to develop.
But could they fall into the feedstock for cellulose?
They could be biomass, but probably not feedstock.
Representative Doty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a rare opportunity with three people in the business at once in front of us to ask this question. Do you find that, say, 150 years ago, I had oak savanna in my area? For the past three or four generations, it's been plowed, it's been sprayed, it's been fertilized, it's been whatever. The 300 species or whatever number used to grow there, if you put those back, how well do they all do? Do you find that we've made so many changes that some native restoration isn't able to be restored?
Representative Doty, there are certainly situations where native plant communities aren't restorable to the landscape if the land is altered dramatically. Now, in the case of like an old savanna that's been farmed, obviously talking about recreating the true native plant community and restoring the savanna itself, well, you're kind of talking about a whole different thing than restoring a grassland for biomass production. However, the grassland species that are the understory of the oak savanna can be restored and sustained or maintained as a sustainable, basically perpetual plant community, provided that some management practices are put into place that will keep it that way. And fortunately for grassland biomass ecosystems, just the very nature of harvesting them annually or semi-annually helps to encourage or promote that, or leads to that sustainability. So does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. Representative Scalzi, do you have anyone else? Or?
I think they've covered it pretty well, and we're trying to be respectful of the committee's time. And so for my concluding remarks, I don't know what I can say that would enhance what those previous three testifiers did and the one before them as well, and the good job that Mr. Arnasty has done. So unless he has some concluding remarks.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would just leave you with one last thought, which is the lands that we've been able to conserve and the lands that we're attempting to conserve with additional appropriations are critical. Those are the best quality, the highest value for our natural resources. What this program is really targeted to is the next tier over, productive ag land that is too sensitive to be an annual intensive agriculture. And we have developed a program here that can put that into productive agriculture while buffering and enhancing the value of those core permanently protected areas, but leave this in productive agriculture. And so we ask you to think of conservation programs as laying right alongside these areas, and think in terms of how these lands, these working agricultural lands for biomass, will complement our core protected areas and complement our natural resources.
And I would just like to, Chair, I would just like to thank the committee for their time and their patience. We've taken up a lot of time, and we're very happy to share our stories with you and share the expertise of the testifiers that we had. We're very concerned in Minnesota about providing jobs, and I think they've shown how we can provide jobs, and it sounds like we can provide jobs right out of the chute. And we just want to jumpstart this market, and that's what government is for, to jumpstart the market and then let the market take its course. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Well, I believe Representative Gunter, I'm going to hand the gavel over to you.
Okay. I'm going to take first. Representative Hansen moves House File 1786 to consider for possible inclusion in the environment finance on the proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1786 I introduced last year, looking at bond proceeds for when we do a wetland restoration to measure the carbon sequestration involved with that restoration. I believe we've heard testimony previously about sequestration in upland areas, but the need for getting information back and documenting through the science how much are we capturing in the biomass and in the root systems of the native plants, and in the aquatic restoration, what happens when we start with a field, break the tile, restore the wetland, how much carbon is sequestered. House File 1786, I believe, has moved through a couple other committees. I would ask that we take this concept. We do know that as a bonding bill, we cannot fund the research with bonding. But if there's an opportunity for some type of measurement so we can get data as we do these projects to look at how much carbon are we capturing, and I believe Representative Gunter had mentioned to me earlier that folks are starting to trade now those carbon credits, and so having some way of documenting when we do a wetland restoration, what are we capturing and storing. I'll take any questions on 1786.
Any questions from your members? You want to...
I would renew my motion for possible inclusion.
All right. Thank you.
House File 2731. I would move House File 2731 for possible inclusion in on this capital assessment.
House File 2731 is so moved in the... further input from you.
I am going to call a few speakers up here. First, I would like to make note in your packet, and maybe for members of the audience, a letter from Ducks Unlimited. While you're looking for that, I'll go through the bill. House File 2731 is the bill that I would intend to be the vehicle that would move out of this subcommittee to the full finance committee. It appropriates 54 some change million dollars to the Board of Water and Soil Resources for capital improvement projects. 43.6 million would go for conservation easements for the traditional RIM program. Of that appropriation, 3.6 is to administer the program. I do set aside of the overall RIM dollars 2.4 to be available in the Seven County flood relief area based on the testimony we had heard earlier, and I would ask Mr. Jaskey maybe note that again, that there's 2.4 million in demand for RIM likely appropriated in the special session. I also increase over the governor's numbers, go to 9.84 million for the wetland restoration and mitigation banking for road replacement. And then on the back, I provide $850,000 for Grass Lake. That's about half of what the request was. So in general, this is a significant increase in the number of in the funds going to the Board of Water and Sewer Resources in the governor's budget. I would like to contrast, and I think that's probably what most folks will have questions on. I believe it's more important to put money into the existing RIM program where we can capture $1.4 of federal money and increase the total amount of money that can go into that program. I will also be bringing forward an amendment on Monday to allow for the harvest per the statute for capturing some of that biomass for feedstock for the cellulosic ethanol. I believe that that's the way where we can move immediately rather than starting the program, developing the rules, getting it established, planting the seed, waiting 3 to 4 years before the seed is established, that we have existing RIM lands now that are harvestable. And if we do management on the new lands, there's an ongoing harvestable biomass that could be there that we have the opportunity also to capture additional federal dollars. Finally, on the wetland banking for road and bridge replacement, if we pass a transportation bill, there will be road and bridge projects, and we will need more money than what the governor has provided in his recommendation. More projects will need more mitigation efforts. Also, the Grass Lake project, I believe, is an important project that we need to have. So with that, I would like to have Tim Kohler from NRCS come forward and just detail both the federal matching opportunities and the economic impact of the Wetland Restoration RIM partnership.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Kohler. Would you give your name for the record, please?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Tim Kohler. I work for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Natural Resources Conservation Service. You've heard a number of great presentations today related to different things with the environment, different things with easements, different things with vegetation. Representative Hansen's proposal, maybe I could speak to a couple of points that were made earlier by Mr. Jaffe. We have had some great accomplishments, and we have had some challenges. One of the challenges, as all of you are aware of, is, and I'll reiterate what Mr. Jaffe has said, we did lose $13 million of federal funding last year in the Federal Wetlands Reserve Program, WRP. Because of our lower rates for appraisal, as well as a lack of a bonding bill, we had to send that money back. In addition to that, as Mr. Jaffe also mentioned, right now there is still $60 million in Washington that is unspoken for. Talked to Washington just before I got here this morning. They'd be willing to send all of it to us right now. The challenge is that the money has to be obligated by March 15th. So it's pretty unlikely that we can make that work possibly with a RIM WRP effort. But there is also the chance that depending on what happens with omnibus spending bill in Washington, they could extend that March 15th deadline potentially if we don't have a farm bill. So I would sure encourage the subcommittee and others to continue to push for this, because the match and the effort that we work on together with RIM WRP is a really an excellent opportunity to get habitat on the ground, as well as alternative uses of that habitat. And maybe I can speak to that real quick, Representative Hansen. We have the same similar type of ability with our WRP easements to manage the sites for habitat, but also to provide the landowner the ability to mow it, to harvest it, and to take those residues off of those lands, as long as it's according to a conservation plan, that we can ensure won't hurt wildlife habitat, won't hurt the water quality. So I think from everything that we've seen, we should be able to work real closely together to potentially provide some alternative and additional benefits to those lands, to those RIM lands. Maybe the last point, and I believe it was in the Bowser packet that all of you received, we were asked to provide a little bit of economic information to the subcommittee. And I just would, if think it says executive summary, and I believe, like I said, it's in the, was it in one of the last pages, I believe, in the Bowser packet. Pretty sure it was there, wasn't it, John?
I don't think it was in their packet.
Okay, it wasn't. Okay. I can explain real quick on what it is. What we did was did a quick analysis of the economic impact of easements, especially WRP easements, on the Minnesota economy. We have a couple of economists at our state office who work with the university and others, and they run some economic models that are pretty standard models that are pretty well understood, as well as by economists, of course. I'm not sure I understand some of them, Mr. Chairman. What it basically did, a couple of just real quick points, is that we used an estimate of something like $16.5 million of WRP is what we were estimating that we could get still this year with a new farm bill when it is passed. That amount of money, our projections would be, is that it would create and or support something like 261 jobs in the state. So that would translate to roughly a job for every $63,000 of WRP money that was put into it. Obviously, if you put a rim on top of the WRP or with the WRP, you know, you could proportionally increase those increases of jobs and maintenance of jobs. The other thing that that the model does is it deals with the production of goods and services, kind of an output perspective, and that $16.5 million roughly would equate to about almost $26 million. So about almost $1.60 for every dollar that we would spend would be producing goods and services. As a corollary, or as a same type of discussion, that same $16.5 million, if you look at it a different way, would be somewhere in the neighborhood of almost $24 million of wages and capital income. So in other words, there's the ability to, about for every dollar that we would put into it, get about $1.50 back in wages and income. Now, just as a caution, they're separate calculations, so you don't add the two numbers together. I'd like to claim that we could get $50 million of benefits out of a $16 million investment, but I'm just talking about some rough economic analysis that we did over a few day period. So I think the bottom line there is in addition to all the environmental things that we've all been talking about, in addition to the potential cellulosic energy potential, we also have a tremendous economic advantage to these easement programs. And I guess with that, I'll stop and see if there's any questions, or turn it back to Representative Hanson.
Representative
Dean.
Thank
you. Representative Hanson, it's always good that when we spend taxpayers' dollars, we can give them multiple number of benefits rather than just one benefit for a project. And so I'm trying to see how many multiple benefits we can get out of your proposal. And I am hearing multiple benefits. I am thinking about the ducks, our duck friends, who are always telling us the upland grasslands around the wetlands for nesting. And I think that's part and parcel of what you are after here. Just help me out, sir.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, there are multiple multipliers in the proposal here, and I will ask Mr. Kohler to talk about, with the wetland restoration, that there is wetlands and uplands that are that there's a ratio to be required. The benefits here are that you provide wildlife habitat, protect water quality, restore a wetland that was probably there previously. You are potentially providing that seed source for cellulosic ethanol, because you have to manage. You can't just plant a prairie or replant prairie around a wetland and harvest it right away. You've got to manage it. Traditionally, that's been done with burning. There's been grazing. There are a number of tools that are used to mimic or recreate what happened in the natural environment 200 years ago when we had bison and other ungulates that were grazing. So we're protecting, providing wildlife habitat,
protecting water quality, holding the soil in place, providing habitat for pollinators that are needed also for agriculture. We are providing a home with that habitat for wildlife. We're providing storage for rainfall capacity that helps with downstream flooding. We can tie this into some areas where there's flooding that's occurring, where they're coming, where entities are coming to us and asking for dikes. Maybe we can capture that water upstream. And all that while matching with existing REM. We can match with federal money and still provide the management, intensively managed harvest that can provide the feedstock for the biofuel that we had before.
Well, going back to our duck friends, we know that they're happiest to make a prairie tough one. I think we've all established that. But I was pleasantly pleased by the three testifiers who said that here is a Minnesota industry that is ripe for expansion. Of course, that'll never be exported overseas or even outside the state. So we can create a lot more local jobs in an industry that is asking for it, right before it. So it seems to me that we can say seeds of a local each type, when we weren't sure we could do that before, and help not only the ducks, but the biofuels, and the businesses. Am I getting that right?
Mr. Chair, I think you're getting that right and more, because you're providing the jobs for the feed industry and the expansion of the feed industry. You then provide the jobs for the biofuels industry. Mm-hmm. You're providing construction jobs, bringing the backhoe out there, breaking the tile, having the cat move around. You've got the construction jobs there. And then when it's completed, you also can have the potential for tourists. I mean, we have elsewhere, in other committees, we're going to see the demand for wildlife management areas, for searches by the DNR for hunting properties. Mm-hmm. What this does is it keeps this land private. It's still going to be on the tax roll for paying property tax, not coming off the roll. It stays private, but it provides habitat and hunting opportunities if the landowner desires. And you're seeing this value that's there with wetland restoration. I think Mr. Kohler can say that you're seeing with wetland restoration an appreciation of the value of the land around us because of that natural amenity. So you're getting even more multipliers than what you had said.
Wouldn't you also have the fact, Representative Hansen, of having this vegetation act as a filtering strip to keep our waters cleaner and prevent the problem Representative Beard was talking about?
That's correct. We want to keep the soil and the nutrients in place, and the way to do that is with vegetation.
Mr. Kohler.
Mr. Chairman and subcommittee members, too, and I just want to make sure that we also are being realistic with everything too. That we prescribe and the Board of Water and Soil Resources prescribe to us, if I may talk for you, that this is according to a plan too. So it isn't just willy-nilly out there cutting in the middle of the duck nesting season and destroying all the ducks, or cutting the same thing over and over and over again where then all of a sudden you have non-native species start coming in or whatever. So this is going to be with the landowner's wishes and the agency's wishes and the industry's wishes to, according to a plan that will deal with water quality and will deal with the ducks and will deal with the potential for energy production and others. So that's a key, and the nice thing with the easements that we have is that they basically say we work with the landowners, but we have to still remember that we took the easement for some primary benefits of water quality and wildlife, et cetera. So we just can't blow off one in favor of the other. So, for instance, with energy production and Bowser's perspective is this way too, we may, for instance, only cut a third of an easement a year to make sure that You know, that there's still enough of different levels of habitat, you know, older stuff that the older vegetation, for instance, that certain species can still use. Because if we make it all look like a lawn every year, for instance, and, you know, it's that thick out there, there's not much habitat for wildlife, for instance, and it wouldn't be as good for water quality, et cetera. So I think that's an important point, is that we really prescribe to working with the landowner, developing a plan that tries to deal with as many of the environmental benefits as possible. So,
any other questions?
Seeing none.
Mr. Clark, could you bring the economic, that written economic analysis to the committee so that members can see that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, and subcommittee members, yes, I will. I can provide that to the subcommittee for your use. And again, you know, my economists are very leery about something that didn't take them 100 years to develop and is peer reviewed by 50 other economists. So the information is a very good starting point, I think that the numbers are something that mean a lot, and it shows the cumulative impacts on the economy and jobs and everything else. Yes, I will provide that to the subcommittee.
I think it looks like someone else might have something to say.
Yes,
Ms. Eric. Welcome to the committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Judy Erickson, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Stormwater Conservation Districts. And there has been great discussion today on all these issues. And for the association, our legislative committee and our board have reviewed the request that Bowser made to the governor for his consideration in the bonding bill, and then, of course, looking at what the governor provided. And our priority as an organization is RIM Reserve. And our second priority would be RIM Clean Energy. We did have folks that worked on the RIM Clean Energy program, but our priority is RIM Reserve because it is an existing program. I was making a list as you guys were talking about the benefits, and that's quite a long list. I hadn't really thought about it in all that many ways before, but, you know, wetland restoration, habitat, water quality, federal money at a time when Minnesota, we give more to Washington out of our taxpayer dollars than we get back, and this is a way to get money back from Washington. That's a huge benefit. Then there's the whole job issue, seed source for cellulosic ethanol, keeping land in private ownership, and then there's recreational opportunities. That's, I don't know how many wins that is, but that's a lot. You know, and I think that the leveraging is a huge thing. I don't know if this was stated earlier today or not, but currently an application for wetland restoration projects, there is $50 million in applications waiting and ready to go that landowners have been identified for. So as soon as the legislature makes this money available, you know, there are landowners lined up and ready to go, in addition to trying to get that $60 million that's still in Washington. So the governor's recommendation of $20 million leverages, as they said, approximately $30 million in federal funds. Representative Hansen's bill would leverage $60 million in funds for a total of $100 million for this area. And even if there are, you know, questions until we see what the Farm Bill actually does provide, the fact that there are, I believe, about 300,000 acres of CRP lands coming out, there's plenty of opportunities out there for RIM Reserve partnering with WRP and or keeping the federal dollars that have already been spent on these conservation lands in place. So thank you very much for your consideration, and we look forward to working with you.
Thank you.
Ms. Erickson, you mentioned the federal match and that there's federal match with RIM, but there is not an existing program matching with RIM Clean Energy. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman,
Robertson
and
Hanson,
that
is my understanding, yeah. Is that correct,
Mr. Fuller?
Yes. Okay.
I think we have another testifier here, Mr. Harnack.
Welcome to the committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Harnack, representing the Red River Watershed Management Board. And just want to speak in support of the RIM Reserve Program. It continues to be a very valuable component as part of flood damage reduction and natural resource enhancement that we advocate in the Red River Valley. A few years ago, we had a mediation agreement. Projects had come to a halt because everything was considered to be very single benefit project proposals, and we had a difficult time getting permits from the feds and from the state. Through an agreement with state agencies and locals and interest groups, we have a balanced approach to looking at flood damage reduction and natural resource enhancement in the Red River Valley. Rim Reserve is a significant component of that, particularly as it relates to river restoration. We have two projects that are underway right now that historically were constructed drainage systems by the federal government. And the capacity of one of those was like 6,300 CFS. Now its capacity is 2,500 CFS. Mainly because of the sedimentation and that takes place within the river system. It's not sustainable. So what our projects are doing is providing setback levees anywhere between 500 to 1,000 feet on each side of the river system that provides agricultural protection to the landowners and prevents the water from just running cross-country in our flat landscape up there in the Red River Valley. And then the project restores the sinuosity of the river, which creates a stable channel, enhances fish and wildlife habitat, and kind of that ecosystem enhancement as part of our natural resource component of our flood damage reduction projects. The advantage of Rim Reserve is we can use that in leveraging with CRP and reduce the overall state costs and local costs. And in some cases, what we're seeing, we're using, because land values have gone up tremendously. 5 years ago, we were paying $850 for land. Now we're paying $800 to $2,300 for the same parcel. When you got $15 wheat, $11 beans, and $5 corn, you're going to have to pay more for the land. We need a way and means to incent landowners to participate in these kinds of programs. So when you can leverage federal money, state money, and if we need to augment that, you know, with a little bit of local money in these natural resource projects, it's a win-win for everybody. And the state wins in terms of habitat, resource enhancement, as well as not having to pay the damages for flood control damages for roads, bridges, and other damages in the valley. So we appreciate the efforts and certainly support the Rim Reserve program and the compliment to our efforts.
Appreciate that. You should live with Representative Hansen's family farm as it's worth over $4,000 an acre. Any other questions from the members?
Representative Hansen, are you looking to buy?
Yeah.
Thank you.
My brother now, Bill, is now jealous that I have the 40 acres that is tillable. He has the 40 acres that is woodland. He was laughing at me before, but he's not laughing anymore. Any other questions? Representative Hansen removed his motion to have House File 2731 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Environment Finance Capital Investment Bill.
I just have one final comment.
Okay.
You'll see that this is $54 million. And we've been talking about wins and multipliers, and I do want to note that we only have a limited amount of money. Depending on the forecast and also other bonding requests, I think we need, I just want to caution that there's probably not going to be $54 million there. But we want to try to use the money that we can get very effectively. And I believe Rim Reserve capturing as much federal dollars as we can get, putting it on the landscape this year, if we can, creating jobs, providing the biofuels opportunity, protecting water quality, providing wildlife life habitat, is what we need to do to the maximum extent possible.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the audience? Reverend Hansen, you want to join or you want me to?
You can do it.
We're adjourned.